This is Barbara Peters, and I'm again talking with Dana Stabenow about a completely different project from her Alaskan novels with Kate Shugak and Liam Campbell, which we earlier discussed, and you should listen to that podcast too. The Eye of Isis novels, what was the inspiration for those?
Well, boy, it was a long time brewing. There was a Cleopatra exhibit in the late 90s. Don't even ask me when. I don't know. It was at the Field Museum in Chicago. And just about that time, Alaska Airlines started flying direct from Anchorage to Chicago. And I thought, well, I should go see that. So a couple of friends and I went down there to see the Cleopatra exhibit. And I had always been interested in Cleopatra because it just seemed like so many historical judgments of her seemed just so off the wall and unfair. So this exhibit was a revelation. This was the revisionist Cleopatra history. And one of the things that really stuck with me, I still have the book from the exhibit, but one of the things that really stuck with me was that almost everything that we know about Cleopatra was written by historians in the pay of Augustus Caesar. And he had a huge axe to grind when it came to how she would be viewed. And of course, you know, the woman tempted me and I ate it is a very old story. It may be the first story. And so I started investigating a little bit more. I started reading a little bit more about Cleopatra, but I wasn't even thinking about writing about her, not as yet. And then, not very long ago, 5, 10 years ago, can't keep track anymore, Stacy Schiff wrote her biography of Cleopatra, which basically underlined everything that the exhibit in Chicago had said. And I read it 2 or 3 times, and I extrapolated some information from it, and the things that we don't know about Cleopatra are infinitely, you know, larger in number than the things that we do know about her. For example, her mother is not named in the record. Now, it very probably was Ptolemy's sister, Cleopatra, whatever, but she isn't named. So that leaves that open to the interpretation of your nasty little novelist that comes along and decides that she's going to name Cleopatra's mother herself, and I do. Well, I won't yet. I won't, not in the first book, I don't. But she's a fascinating character, and because she has been so, I don't even know how to say it. I mean, I don't like to characterize, you know, what people did 2,000 years ago, because it's not like I lived then or knew anything about it. Maligned, really, you know, and then again, as I say, you know, the woman tempted me and I ate it. Octavius had a serious investment. You could even say that in part at least, his ascendancy to being emperor of Rome rested on the fact that he totally trashed her reputation. He looted Alexandria, basically, to buy his way, you know, onto a throne in Rome. And naturally, everything that is written about her afterward is going to be to her detriment. It's going to be all her fault. It's going to be, you know, Antony, oh dear, this wonderful Roman hero who was completely seduced by this evil woman. And then in Stacy Schiff's biography, she points out that women had rights in Alexandria at that time. I know it's astonishing to think of that, but it is absolutely true. They could own property. They could marry where they chose. They could divorce. They could get alimony. They could keep custody of kids. They could own businesses. They could operate them. I found it's not a hieroglyphic. It's an illustration of a woman selling cones of sugar from a boat on the Nile to a bigger boat. And it's a woman. She's, you know, she's in business. She's selling the sugar to the, you know, the boats that need sugar on the Nile, wherever that was. And that seemed extraordinary to me. And then I thought to myself, the women in Rome were totally constrained. They were supposed to stay home and weave, essentially. That was your duty, and procreate, you know? That was your duty. You weren't supposed to do anything else. You weren't allowed outside, really, you know, without a scarf over your head. I mean, basically Muslim countries nowadays was what Rome was then. They couldn't own property. They had no authority over their children. They could be divorced. They could be set aside by their husbands, you know, at a whim. Caesar did it twice. So it seemed to me that you have, on the one side in the Mediterranean, Alexandria, where women have power, and then you have Rome, where women don't. And the men are probably looking at Alexandria thinking, well, that's not right. And not to mention which they grow all our food.
Yes. Egypt was the breadbasket of Rome, which I'm not sure that people...
It was the breadbasket of the world.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that, but yeah, because of the Nile inundation, that was true. It's also important to remember that Alexandria is not an Egyptian city, it was a Greek city.
Yes, it
founded
was.
Founded by Alexander, mm-hmm, in point of fact, so it wasn't a really old city.
Mm-mm. It's only 330 years old. Yeah.
Right, and today a lot of it is underwater. I went to visit the British Museum's really excellent... exhibit of underwater Alexandria, because they've sent lots of divers down there and they're looking at things. So it wasn't a Roman city. And I've often thought that the parallels between all of that that you're talking about and Shakespeare's version of Richard III had a lot to do with it. I'm not necessarily a Ricardian. He mm-hmm. may well have been a bad guy, but the truth is, the person with the biggest investment in trashing Richard III was Henry VII,
mm-hmm,
because he was...
It is a very similar situation.
It really
yes.
is. You know, he's the Tudor with a really mm-hmm. shaky claim to the throne, and those two kids were in his way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard. You know, they could have died of natural... There are all kinds of things. But the point is that history is usually written by the victors, mm-hmm, you know, by the winners.
Mm-hmm.
And the other point is, which has gone, that history, there are very few women's voices in history,
mm-hmm,
up until more recent times. So it was mostly written by men, mostly written by victors. And mm-hmm. so we don't really know. The other thing you and I discovered when we were in Egypt, which I think is fascinating, is that Cleopatra's is one of the tombs that has never been found.
Mm-hmm.
Neither has Alexander's, mm-hmm, neither has Nefertiti.
Or Antony's.
Or mm-hmm, Akhenaten.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do know from our time in Egypt is that for forever, the story about Hatshepsut, the first female pharaoh,
mm-hmm,
ruling as, quote, a man, was murdered by her stepson Thutmose, whom she'd kind of edged off the throne. And everybody believed that, you know, which I thought was...
And she was demonized. Let's not forget.
Yes.
Remember the YA novel that you and yeah. I both had read? There? It was called Mara, Daughter of the Nile. It's all about Hatshepsut, bad queen, Thutmose III.
Right.
Yay, him, big, strong man, going to come in and fix everything in Egypt and chisel her cartouche from all her tombs. You know, and I sucked that up when I was a kid and thought, yeah, I'm sure that's right. Not so much.
Well, what's really fascinating is that they managed recently to identify her mummy.
Mm-hmm.
For long story, we don't need to go into, but this is hers. And then they found, strangely, a tooth, which they were able then to fit to a gap in the jaw of the mummy and establish that it was Hatshepsut's tooth, from which they have now decided that what really killed her was a tooth abscess.
It wasn't that much at all.
Right. She died a natural death, and, you know.
He did have issues, though. Don't forget the obelisk in Karnak.
I'm not.
Oh, yeah.
But my point is that, you know, he didn't murder her.
No.
Whatever there.
No.
And so if we ever find the mummy of Cleopatra, and through modern science, DNA testing, and all the rest, if we could ever identify that it was really Cleopatra, it's possible that how she died
mm-hmm.
could be. I mean, remember the whole legend of Anastasia. You know, it took forever to actually find the bodies mm-hmm. of the Romanovs, and then using Prince Philip, I think, his DNA, were able to determine that Anastasia indeed died with the rest of them.
Schiff says it's very possible that Cleopatra died by her own hand from a poison of her own making, because she was very adept and skilled at the...
Right. So the legend of the asp, you know, mm-hmm. may not be true. And mm-hmm. basically, she'd lost everything. What was she, 40-something when she died?
She was about 40, I think. 39, yeah. I think, yeah.
Right, which is not, by today's standards, any great age, mm-hmm. but in her time, you know.
She ruled for 20 years.
Exactly,
yeah.
You know. So there's much to be discovered by Cleopatra.
Mm-hmm.
But meantime, why can't you make up whatever
you
want?
And I can fill in the blanks.
Indeed.
And it's also, you know... This Death of an Eye, I don't mean to offend anybody out there, but Death of an Eye and the issues that Alexandrians are facing every day 2,000 years ago are extremely similar to some of the issues that people are facing today in this world, in the United States and in the UK. So I'm not going to use too heavy a hammer because I don't want to get in the way of the story, but they're there for people who are paying attention.
They are there. So what you decided to do was not make Cleopatra the lead character, but... You have created the Eye of Isis. So
I'm just so proud of that.
You should be. So basically, this is almost, in a sense, sort of like Kate Goes to Egypt, but not. Anyway, who is the Eye of Isis, and where does she, what's her profession? And
I've worked for two different corporations, and every CEO has their own hatchet man. That's what they're called behind their back. They're never called that in their face. But it's the person who delivers the bad news. You know, it's the person who, you know, brings the hammer down when it's necessary. And I thought to myself, every ruler has to have a hatchet man. And I bet if I went back and investigated every ruler who ever lived, they would have had one. And I thought to myself, why wouldn't the Ptolemies have a hatchet man? And then I thought to myself, why wouldn't it be hereditary? And then I thought to myself, Alexandria, and there's no reason that an eye can't also be a woman. And again, going back to what Karen Autumn had said, and I'm continually writing books about strong women, you know, seemed pretty much of a natural fit for me and for the character.
So basically, the Eye of Isis is an investigator and, as you say, sort of hatchet girl for Cleopatra. Mm-hmm. We are, where, early in Cleopatra's reign. She's very pregnant with Caesar's child.
Yes.
In this first book. So what year is that, roughly?
Oh, God, you would ask me that.
Sorry.
I'd have to go look. It's a something.
How far is she into it? Do you remember?
She's 18 years old.
Okay, so she's very early on in
her
reign.
Well, I want lots of room, you know, in case I want to write lots of books.
No, I understand that. When I asked you the date question, it was really more a question of where in Cleo's
life. I want to say 53 BC, but I don't think that's right.
That's okay. That doesn't matter. What matters is how old Cleopatra is. And the Eye of Isis kind of comes into this job sideways, right?
No, she does. She says at the end to the queen, was this a commanded test? And of course it was. You know, Cleopatra may not admit to it, but of course it was a test. The whole case was a test. Finding out who, you know, had killed the previous eye. And Cleopatra, I think, knew all along.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say the setup is that the previous Eye of Isis has been killed. Mm-hmm. And so Cleopatra turns to a girlhood friend, Tintasheri, and asks her to investigate and see if she can determine why the eye was killed.
Mm-hmm. And by whom?
Yes.
Yes.
And actually the why might be more important than the whom in the story. So Tintasheri, whom you refer to as Sherry with an I, S-H-E-R-I, agrees to do it. Mm-hmm. And she has stuff going on in her own life as well. Mm-hmm. But so basically it's almost like a private investigator.
Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, you can't call her that, but she's the Eye of Isis. But,
right.
And she's not necessarily, it's not a big, people are aware, they're going to recognize the symbol that she carries, but it's not people don't necessarily always know who the Eye of Isis is. And in this case, they won't know who she is.
So she has a badge of office, mm-hmm. right?
Which is? The eye. I describe it. At the beginning of the first chapter of the prologue, when the previous Eye of Isis lies dying, it's picked up by the moonlight.
So in the book, Cleopatra has an evil brother, a co-ruler, mm-hmm. who obviously would like to bump her off and mm-hmm. seize the whole throne for himself.
But Caesar was insistent that he couldn't. The Senate in Rome was well aware of how ambitious he was for power. And if he had declared himself the ruler of Egypt, they would have hit the roof, and he probably would have been assassinated a lot sooner than he had been. So he was the strong man on the scene, and he said, you're going to be co-rulers, because there's always been co-rulers in Egypt, and get along. And then he left.
The Ptolemies have always had a history of sharing power, but they also have that same pharaonic thing, a history of brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. Or probably most of them are half brothers and half sisters.
Well, they all
getting together.
People are all building, nothing is created in a vacuum. People always build on what came before. Remember in, I think it was Karnak, when we went deep into the enormous temple. And we go finally to the last, whatever you want to call it, and Alexander had been there, you know, and built his own little chapel inside this other humongous I don't know, tomb or temple or whatever you want to call it.
It's the temple of Luxor. And he indeed inserted
chapel. Remember on the side, he's recreated, there are illustrations of him dressed as a pharaoh. So he's stealing from the, he's saying, see me, I'm not so different from you. It's going to be fine. Things are going to go on just like they always were before, except you're going to be paying your taxes to me. That's basically all.
He was setting himself up in the pharaonic tradition. There are so many big questions there. What would have happened if Caesar hadn't been assassinated, which actually opened the way for Augustus to become emperor? So you have to say that the people who knocked off Caesar might not have done anybody a favor, might have been the worst thing they could have done. And we don't know what would have happened if Alexander hadn't, died so young.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he barely had time to, do anything.
Well, and, then his generals split the world up and Ptolemy won. Who might have been his half-brother, Ptolemy might have been Alexander's half-brother, Philip of Macedon's illegitimate son. And he claimed Egypt as, the best of all the prizes for himself. And
it was a huge prize, yeah. It was an enormous prize because it was so wealthy. They brought down, their version of Alaska was Nubia, and, the upper reaches of the Nile, where there was tons of gold and all kinds of other stuff. But the fertility of Egypt in the ancient world was just astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
Even Israel was fertile back then, before climate change and human intervention and other things made such a difference.
Greece. The goats eat all the topsoil, everything down, including the topsoil, and that's why Greece looks the way it is today.
Also, they felled the trees for ships, and why Ephesus is a real study in that. I still remember that. It was one of the great harbors when I was there of the ancient world, and what happened was, and Henry did this in England too, they deforested in order to build the ships. Then the soil ran down and silted up the harbor, and when the harbor became a marsh, the mosquitoes came, and then malaria came, and everybody died, and it went away as a major port. Mm-hmm. And, this is a progression we are seeing
right now.
All around us.
You should come to Alaska. There's a continual pushback against people building on rivers, because when they do, they cut down the brush and the trees, which provides the shade for the salmon and holds the soil in the side of the rivers and provides the shade for the salmon to lay their eggs and milt on the gravel in the shades of those trees. And when you cut down the trees to build a house, all that goes away, and so does the salmon, which is the reason you built the house there in the first place. Hello. God, I'll tell you, we never learn.
We're reading about that today, about Australia. The enormous brush fires there have destroyed the stuff holding the soil, and now it's going to creep into their water system. The silt and all is going to wash down and make, all kinds of problems. So anyway, erosion and all of that has been a huge thing. And in fact, in Egypt today, the Aswan Dam has taken away the annual inundation of the Nile.
Mm-hmm.
When we were there, it was interesting to see that the Great Pyramids of Giza are built up on a plateau so that the Nile inundation didn't reach them. Much of the construction was always allowed for the river to rise up, that red land, black land thing where you could see it.
And I love that I can't remember which guide it was that told us that, and it had never occurred to me, of course, before, what the farmers would do when it was inundation, because they can't plant then, places flooded. They'd go up on the plateau and work on the pyramids and the tombs. Well, of course they would.
The Egyptians had slaves, but they also had an enormous amount of basically conscript labor, people who were willing to work for a wage when they couldn't do their regular thing.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. We should mention at some point here that we actually did go to Egypt.
Just recently, as a matter of fact, last month.
We did. We went in December, and part of the reason, aside from the fact that it was a wonderful trip and fun to travel, in fact, the main reason was for you to actually physically look at Egypt and these sites. How many ideas for books did it give you?
Well, so far, six separate books, six separate novels. I haven't fleshed out the entire outlines and, introduced new characters or anything like that, but there's always a kernel. There's always the kernel from which the book sprouts, and I would say that I have six kernels for six very good plots.
Which is really good news.
Yeah.
And anyone who would like to see part of our trip, if you go to instagram.com/poisonedpenbookstore, all one word, you will find, if you go back into December, you will find a great array of photos of things that Dana and I saw, one of which we went to Alexandria and, you know, saw what is remaining. There's not much left of Cleopatra's Alexandria, but we did see a
lot. What was? The Serapeum and the catacombs are probably just post-dated her.
The catacombs, yeah, they were Roman, but I don't think they were quite in her time. But still, they give us some idea. The most interesting thing to me was actually the new Library of Alexandria, which is amazing. Yeah. How far away is it from the old library?
The guide, as I recall, the guide said it was they as near as they can figure. It's something like 15 meters away from the actual original library stood.
Which is so cool.
Yes, and they have Ptolemy I, whom they a statue of Ptolemy I standing out front, which statue they fished out of the harbor. There's quite the excavation going on, and still going on. The divers are going down and picking up all of these statues and remains of Alexander that sunk beneath the sea after the earthquake.
So there may be more to be discovered.
I would imagine plenty more. Maybe her tomb, you never know.
We went to Memphis, which is, I think you said, the first recorded duty of Cleopatra.
She escorted the new Bacchus bull. The old Bacchus bull had died, and so as a queen, she went and basically incarnated herself as the living Isis and escorted the bull from one side of the Nile to his temple on the other side of the Nile, and took great acclaim. This is her way up. This is another reason why I think she's a lot smarter than people give her credit for. Every Ptolemy in 300 years had been rebelled against by the Egyptians. The original Egyptians greeted Alexander with loud hosannas. They were happy to see him because he was going to save them from some other conqueror that they didn't like. But of course, everybody wears out their welcome. And the Ptolemies certainly wore out theirs quickly. Every single Ptolemy, with the sole exception of Cleopatra, the Egyptians rebelled against. Every single ruler, except for her. And I believe that one of the reasons that happened was she made it happen. She's the only Ptolemy in 300 years who ever bothered to learn to speak Egyptian. She's the only Ptolemy in 300 years who recreated herself as Isis incarnate, who at that time was the biggest cult. Although, oh my God, the Egyptians had plenty of gods. It's hard to keep them all straight. In fact, I'm not even trying.
I agree with you. I think she's a fascinating woman. Much more may be revealed in time as we move along. So the first book is called Death of an Eye. Do you have a title for the second book
I yet? Don't have a title for the second book. I'm not even thinking about it yet because I'm working on the Liam Campbell novel. But that should be done and in by June. And then I'm going to work on the next Eye of Isis novel.
So what we're hoping for is a Liam Campbell in 2021. And a new Eye of Isis novel in probably 2022.
Maybe the end of 2021, if I can manage
Depends on how fast you
write. Yeah, I'm really hot to get into them, so I think, I don't know, maybe it'll be tough, maybe it won't. I do know how it's going to start, the next Eye of Isis novel. It's going to start with Teta Sherry. She's come new into this job, totally unexpecting that she was ever going to have it, totally unprepared, and so she goes to the Library of Alexandria. And the past Eyes of Isis have been writing down their case histories, and so she's going to find a cold case that she has to investigate. Cold case circa 53 BC. Dum dum.
Fabulous. Michael Connelly will be green.
No, he will not. He'll be fine. He'll just go write another Harry Bosch novel.
Harry Bosch really likes cold cases. You know, cold cases are just a godsend to novels about investigators and so forth. It's always wonderful if you can find something in the past that, you know, really kickstarts the present. Well, I think the big challenge for you is going to be able to keep you're writing Kate and you're writing Liam and then you're writing Teta Sherry.
I might have a new idea.
And you might. But I mean, the hard part, it seems to me, is going to be to stay in the moment and finish one before you want to leap on to do, or are you thinking that at some point you might be able to have ideas for one, while you're writing one, and
I already do.
Yeah. And how do you keep them?
I write them down.
Okay.
Because if I don't, I will forget about them.
What a really old-fashioned idea. Right. So once you write them down, doesn't the temptation to go further sort of beckon?
I'm very disciplined, Barbara.
You are very disciplined.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm delighted to hear that. Thank you for talking to me about the Eye of Isis. I'm really excited about all this good work to come.